I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today with Adina Sussman and Raquel Pilzel, talking about recipes, testing, development, how they end up in cookbooks, how they are cooked, so much. But a little background, Raquel and I are actually ships passing in the night, it almost seems, having cooked in Boston. At Number 9 Park, and then going to Cooks Illustrated kind of at the same time that I was there. And then he introduced me to Adina, a good friend of hers, and a recipe tester, developer, cookbook maven for Ellie Krieger, Food Network, and a ton of her own work as well.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for being here. I think I kind of just want to start with a little bit of background, you know, where you got your chops, per se. Raquel, it says that you were from Chicago initially. Yeah?
Yeah, I was in Chicago, and I guess I got into food at a food internship. I was an advertising major, and I kind of started hanging out with the chef more than I should have been. This isn't the case probably with a lot of us. And I was a vegetarian at the time, so I went to a cooking school out in Colorado in a church basement.
So no like Italian hot roast beefs or...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. It Chicago was like all seitan all the way, man. I went out there for a while, and then... I got hired at a bunch of different bakeries in Chicago when I came home, but I was too scared to take any of the jobs because, you know, it was like the mid-90s, I guess, and it was a scary thing to drop everything and go into cooking and make $5 an hour and that kind of thing. So I kept on working in publishing for a while, and then I ended up out in Boston where I went to pastry school down Johnson & Wales, and then you know, I would do this crazy commute every day, and I was working in a bakery at that time, and I kind of took the plunge and then ended up at Cook's and then moved down to Brooklyn and freelanced. So that's my story.
Yeah. Have you ever surmised your culinary career that quickly?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Well done. And Adina, your background, I noted that you grew up in a traditional Jewish home.
Yes, I grew up in a very food-centric Orthodox Jewish home, so home cooking was a big part of our tradition. My mom worked full-time, so she had my sister and I very involved in the cooking, cleaning chickens and making challah bread and things like that at a very young age. So I'd say I had a high comfort level in the kitchen with a very, what I'd say, Hamish or home-style cooking. But as my love of food increased, I would say that my religious observance waned a bit. Although I really did sort of rediscover my passion for cooking and food when I lived in Israel for 5 years after college and sort of got into a green marketing type of a culture of cooking, more seasonal, something that I never really was aware of in college or until after I moved abroad. And I came back and eventually through a variety of circumstances, worked at Gourmet Magazine for 3 years.
Oh, excellent. Doing what?
I was the chief copywriter for the publishing side of the magazine. So I wrote all of the special sections for advertisers and did a lot of writing about wine and produced events for wine clients around the country.
Wandered down to the test kitchen every once in a while.
Exactly. Scrounging for leftovers.
Yeah.
But then I eventually, while I was at Gourmet, I worked in a couple of restaurants, including Beacon with Waldy Miller as a stagiaire. He just took me on.
Yeah.
And then I went to culinary school at ICE in 2004 and 5, and I've been working as a freelancer, recipe developing and testing and writing since 2005.
Yeah. So. It's funny, more so with Adina, that you had your, you know, kitchen sense. And you went and followed that to Israel, you know, having the Orthodox Jewish. And, but whereas you kind of just fled the whole Chicago scene and went to Colorado. Why did you need that transition?
Well, pretty much because I could stay there for free. Yeah. That was the big, I mean, you know, I was a vegetarian at the time and I really wasn't willing to, I guess I wanted to go to cooking school, but, you know, where could I go where I could cook and not have to use meat? That was my primary focus at the time. And it was either in New York or Colorado, right outside in Boulder, actually. Yeah. And my cousin and his wife lived in Boulder, and I knew no one in New York. So I was like, well, there we go. I got in my pickup truck and drove out there. And not only was it a vegetarian cooking class, but someone was allergic to garlic, and there were vegans. Yeah. So it was like no garlic and vegan. And it was kind of insane. But, you know, I really learned a really strong foundation for how to develop flavor, not using meat and using spices. And
I think that word is an amazing one, foundation. And that, you know, sometimes if you eliminate all of the pomp and circumstance of having, you know, this plethora of ingredients and equipment that, you know, and just focus, you become that much better chef and taster.
I think so. And I think if you look at both of our backgrounds, even though the breadth and scope of our work has expanded, the sort of where we got our start definitely informs the kind of work that we do or like to do.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite style of cooking is still home cooking. That's, you know, very soulful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, whether, and Raquel, you know, I was an admirer of her work long before I met her but and became friends with her, but I think similar, I didn't actually know some of that stuff, but I can see that background reflected in your work.
Yeah.
So,
and then why Israel other than, you know, birthright? And
actually I was birthright started long after I was eligible for the age, but I was looking for an adventure, and I was a journalism major, and I just went over there without a job. The other option was moving to New York. I went to school in Boston. And I had spent a lot of time there and was interested in traveling around the Middle East and Europe. So, and I worked in TV, actually. So I was a communications major in college, and I worked as a TV producer. And I spoke fluent Hebrew because of my education from growing up. So I had a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience. It was also a very peaceful time there. So there was a lot of openness. I went to Jordan and Turkey, Morocco, and, you know, and really had great experiences, both, I'd say actually less culinarily at the time because I was still kosher.
But you did mention Green Market when you were over there. Was that like a prolific thing that...
The shuk, or the market, you know, the same as the Arab word for souk, is a big part of Israeli culture. And I think unwittingly you just end up going once or twice a week because it's a real cultural touchstone there. Everyone goes to the market. And it's a little bit less of sort of the precious Green Market image that Americans have.
It's
really
just a
bustling part of life where people go to get, they go there and get their chicken butchered as much as they pick up their vegetables. Mm-hmm. So I think unconsciously it informed my knowledge of food. And when I came back and really made a decision that I wanted to work in the food world, it all sort of, that background and knowledge sort of coalesced and did inform what I did a little bit. Mm-hmm. But partly it was just a lark.
Yeah. You know, it's great, though. I think a lot of people use larks as this transitory way of ending up where they want to be.
If you look at all of us in the food industry, I think most of us didn't realize, we weren't born thinking at age 5, this is where we wanted to end up.
Yeah.
And we're still scratching our heads. How did we get here?
Especially now.
Very David Byrne talking.
The world's changing.
Heads. But, you know, from those beginnings and those travels, you come back and you're both in greater New York City. How do you see that differ from, you know, those travels, your home kitchens? What do you see happening here now There's Green Market Forward, obviously, farm to table, etc. Is it similar to the kind of cooking that you hoped to be a part of? Or
for me, it's more about the stories behind the food. And I think that when you get into food writing and working on cookbooks and writing headnotes and helping chefs kind of bring their vision to the page, and the whole process of writing a cookbook or writing a story about food, getting those stories that are so special and unique to a person is what, I mean, if I can find any project that does that, I don't care if it's local, seasonal, you know, vegetarian, food personality, you know, celebrity chef. It doesn't matter, because it's all about, I think, what connects everyone to food is those special stories that, I don't know, about grandma's whatever. And it's like, you know, everyone can connect to that. I mean, everyone can connect to those tasty things.
Yeah, and I think that because of the nature of work that we do, we both end up being the messenger for someone else's vision and message. Mm-hmm. So I think that you have to be passionate and sort of feel... The projects that are most successful are ones where you do feel a parity with the person and what they're doing.
But does it ever feel kind of disparate, like you're a surrogate and it's not really your voice or your message actually being delivered? Or does it feel like your work as well?
Sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's our job to kind of... you're almost like a translator, ghost writer, kind of, I don't know, for me at least, I start talking to these chefs in my head. You know, we have these make-believe conversations. because, you know, you kind of have to really get on with their voice. You have to figure out, well, what would so-and-so say about this dish or about this vegetable? Or how do I think they would approach talking about this recipe? And of course, you talk to the person whose recipe it is. But, you know, you also kind of have to... And it takes a while to figure that out, their speech patterns and how they, you know, go about it.
Yeah, you have to sort of be able... It's, I think, part of the work that Raquel has done so successfully is you have to be a good, very perceptive about someone's personality and what they're trying to convey. Because a lot of times people have a difficult time conveying their own message, and you have to help them crystallize it and distill it. So only when you get involved in the process and sort of extract the information from them and then take it home and try and put it out on the page does it come out. Sometimes they, I think, say, wow, I can't believe, how did you get that? Because I don't even realize that I said that. So I think there's a certain amount of, it's a certain amount of sorcery involved and guesswork, but it's also just really about being a good listener and combined with great culinary knowledge as well.
Do you think that's why, you know, front of the house is the person servicing the customer and talking to them, because they're relaying that information? Do you ever feel like a GM? Do you ever feel like, you know?
I never thought of it that way.
I think you're both front and back of the house with what we do.
Yeah. We're the hostesses with the mostess, right? It's, and you know, I think passion is key. And it's always difficult when you're working with a chef or a food personality. And I'm sure Adina's gone through this too, when they just hesitate to really open up and I think that's a whole, I'm sure, I don't know what the numbers would be, but I'm sure so many people read a cookbook just to get inspired and just to have fun reading it and this bedside table reading and not necessarily bringing it in the kitchen to cook with it. So you kind of have to believe that people are going to be interested in the weird little details of your life.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It is. I mean, it's also, and these chefs are very attached and passionate about their recipes. So, I mean, think of it, it's like akin to an artist asking another artist to repaint their paintings in a book. You know,
much paint did you put on that
book? Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and sort of there's that moment where they haven't decided whether they trust you yet. And it's totally natural and something you have to live with and accept for a while until the relationship changes or there's like a transference of some sort.
I feel that same way going into kitchens and photographing that, you know, I have to prove to them that I understand it's their space, but I don't want to be servile. You know, that you have to work together. And it's a hard thing to be like, you know, we're symbiotic. We're not like, I'm not a parasite here. Gaining that trust is something just by, you know, going there over and over and showing that you're in passion and care about it too. But it's sometimes as strenuous as, you know, whatever they're doing. And So I've always found that fascinating, you know, that you're not this secondary, tertiary job. You are, you know, just as important.
Yeah, I think, and I think that they, you know, there's a big difference between a chef-driven recipe and a recipe that someone's going to make at home, and once they realize that you're bringing something to the table also from a food perspective, that's different than from, and then, and they appreciate that, and that you're helping to sort of convey their message in a way, right. You know, and clarifying things, you know, making things more accessible to home cooks, simplifying techniques, all that stuff that, you know, is obviously not in their purview for whatever reason. Yeah. Or it's just not the way they think.
Just logistically, they're thinking of their restaurant kitchen more so than cooking at home.
Yeah. Sous chefs and dishwashers. And
Most
normal people don't have that. So,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Someone should write a cookbook with dishwashers and sous chefs and, you know, actually write a cookbook for a restaurant.
Yeah.
So, like,
right. You don't write, have your prep cook chop five pounds of onions for you.
Right. Call up the distributor and make sure the fish is getting there on time.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, transitioning into cookbooks themselves, Adina, you've worked with Ellie for quite some time. How did you originally get that introduction?
Like most relationships, it came very randomly. Actually, a good friend of mine from Gourmet, Jackie Torin, who was Sarah Moulton's sous chef in the Gourmet kitchen, she knew Ellie, but only because they had interned at CNN together as teenagers. So it wasn't actually a food connection. And she connected us back in 2006 when Ellie was just sort of starting to become well-known, and she had a show on the Food Network. And we lived near one another, and we sort of hit it off personality-wise, and I really came to it with a lot of humility because she gave me a big opportunity. So I think she saw that I was really open to learning and working with her and collaborating.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did about 20 recipes for the first book. And when I say did, I mean, I don't want to take away from her participation, because it's not like she just sort of says, okay, you go ahead and develop this and I'm going to put my name on it. It is a very collaborative process, and there's a lot of discussion about each recipe. But, you know, we just sort of built trust through, I would say not success, but through over time, like horizontally. And I've now worked on 3 books with her, and I do other projects with her as well. And we brainstorm together. So it's been a nice relationship and opened a lot of doors for me.
Yeah. So. I kind of like that you have that humility of initially meeting her and.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was, unlike Raquel's been doing it longer than I have. Actually, and also with Ellie, the relationship is purely a food, and to this day Ellie does her own writing for the book, so I'm hopefully now getting into, I can't discuss yet with whom, hopefully going to be co-writing books the way Raquel does, but until now my participation in books has been purely recipe driven.
So
that was also great for me, a great education professionally, and I love it. I still love doing that.
And then your first book, was it Two Dudes One Pan?
No.
Long before that.
Oh, yeah?
Gosh. The first book that I ever worked on, the first cookbook I worked on was called The Quick Recipe. It was for Cooks Illustrated.
Yeah.
And it actually won a James Beard Award. And it was very exciting. I worked on all of the dessert recipes for that. And then I wrote the chapters for that book. For the dessert section,
yeah.
The 3 or 4 chapters of desserts. And then my first kind of full-on collaboration project was with Sevier Saran, who is just on Top Chef Masters.
Oh, yeah.
And he has Davey on 18th Street. He's a great guy and an amazing cook and an amazing person. And we met during the blackout in 2003 because we were neighbors. So, you know, these things kind of happen randomly, I guess.
Yeah. They always do.
Yeah.
So, randomly... my first introduction to, I've been shooting this back of the house project about the lives of chefs in kitchens. I remembered like a week ago, I saw Ken Oringer, who was a chef at Clio in Boston. And it was one of the first 2 kitchens that Number 9 Park that I was in. That my dad is a very chatty Cathy. He met this guy who happened to be Ken's twin brother and told him what I was trying to do. And it's like, oh, just have him call up my brother. And that was it.
It's amazing,
yeah,
right?
My dad met him while the guy was getting fitted for glasses at a mall in Westchester.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think in more cases than not, that something like that is the is the spark.
Yeah. But it's amazing that, you know, people think there's this protocol in getting into these professions and jobs. Mm-hmm. And really it's just... What is it, Dr.
It's just
John?
Doing
right
anything
place,
you
right
can.
Time.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, you know, not feeling that you're above taking any assignment.
Yeah.
I mean, you take, because you never know, like something that you make $50 from could lead you to meeting someone.
Mm-hmm.
Or, it's all about just being open and receptive, I think, to everything because, that's where the interesting projects come from, these random kind of.
There are a lot of us doing this, but I think that. The people that I've experienced who are most successful are able to go with the flow.
Yeah.
You have to be, just be able to, you know, if you're dealing with a lot of personalities and a lot of different kinds of people and trying to understand a lot of different perspectives. So it's fun. It's being a little bit of a soothsayer for someone else, you know.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about some of the other personalities you two have worked with. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
Public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Greenhorn Radio, hosted by Severin von Scharner Fleming, every Thursday at 2 p.m. Greenhorn Radio is radio for young farmers by young farmers. Helmed by acclaimed activist, farmer, and documentarian Severin Fleming, Greenhorn Radio is a weekly phone interview session surveying America's cutting-edge under 40 farmers. Again, that's every Thursday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Adina Sussman and Raquel Pazell, recipe testers, developers, cookbook writers, excellent cooks.
Gotta
all
that.
Of the
thank
above.
You.
Yeah. I mean, you can't be a cookbook tester, developer, writer, and not be a good cook. You can't just have the, you know, side of the brain that can put it together without it having, you know, tastes good, right?
Totally. Yeah. You have to love getting in there, getting dirty.
Yeah.
I think it comes from a passion for cooking. All of this.
Yeah.
When you get back to it. So.
Yeah.
And home cooking at home.
Yeah. How often do you actually cook at home?
5-6 nights a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have 2 kids, so yeah, we go through a lot of food.
Yeah. And I am single and have no kids, but I'd say I cook recreationally 2-3 times a week, but by dint of what I do, there's something that I've made in the fridge almost every day.
Yeah.
I mean, we're often in the kitchen cooking all day, too. I mean, sometimes you can, you know, work on 5 recipes in a day.
Exactly.
And even though, you know, you still might be cooking dinner at night, you've been cooking all day, but that was work.
So yeah.
Different,
and there,
you know.
And there is, I think we've talked about this, there's a strong desire to sort of cook something different than what you were cooking for work.
Mm-hmm.
Because while some things are appetizing and delicious, it at the end of the day, it feels there, some of it is work, and you have to keep your passion for cooking going. You have to cook the things you want to make with ingredients that you crave and that you love, you know.
So how often do you befall the rote thing of like, oh, I'm doing chicken casserole again, or I'm doing just bread all the time? Have there been like cookbooks or assignments where you just got sick of the singular object that you've been cooking?
Oh, yes. I'm working a great assignment for the American Lamb Board right now, and it's really fantastic and fun and great, but I'm eating a lot of lamb.
Yeah.
It's a lot of lamb.
And I just developed 20 recipes for Dr. Prager's vegetarian pancakes and how to use them in recipes as an ingredient as opposed to just as sort of a pancake.
That's interesting.
And they were very pleased with the recipes, but I got to tell you, there were a couple of months there where, you know, it was a lot of recipes and I was really trying to perfect them. And I would puree they're an Indian style pancake and I used it as the base for a coconut curry, actually, because it had all the seasonings in it and it had whole peas. It worked very nicely, but curry, there was like a month after that where I just couldn't look at a curry.
Yeah, you start sweating.
Yeah.
Emitting curry.
Yeah. But I was happy with the result. Yeah.
So from singular, you know, subjects to, you know, singular subjects. Mm-hmm. I really do want to talk about the Two Dudes, One Pan, because we'll get back to Sevier. But I think you hit on them before all this exemplary fame came.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you said, you know, humanistic story. Is that the route that you found them?
I got hooked up with John and Vinny through our cookbook editor, Pam Krause, who was at Clarkson Potter and now is at Rodale. And she's pretty amazing. And
That's John Shook and Vinny
Joe from
Animal.
Yeah, from Animal Out in LA. And now they have Son of a Gun, their second restaurant. And they're just great guys. I mean, they're hysterical. Like, so I was meeting them for the first time, and they flew me out to LA. And because, you know, I mean, I was in Brooklyn, they're in LA, and we're trying to write this cookbook together. And I got to get their voice, and I got to get what they're all about. And, you know, two young guys. And at that time, they didn't have a restaurant yet. And they were working out of their bungalow in Los Feliz and, you know, their catering company. Yeah. And I get off the plane and Johnny's there to meet me. And he's got like this long, crazy, really curly hair. And he's like, "Raquel, it's great to meet you. We got to go get a washing machine." Okay. So we go to like some Super Saver discount store. You know, we pick out a washing machine, take it to the house. Like, you know, the great thing is a lot of people love that cookbook because they really feel like John and Vinny are there. Like, they're talking to them. And I think that's when you really write something that's successful, because you feel like the chefs are there talking to you and it's in their voice and you get their kind of vibe from it.
So how much time did you actually spend with them while out in LA?
I was with them for 5 days.
Yeah.
So, I stayed in a hotel, but I was with them, you know, morning till night every day for 5 days and hanging out and eating and talking. And, you know, they're both very different people. So it was great to get a sense of who they are. Because so often John and Vinny get kind of lumped into John and Vinny, you know.
Yeah.
They don't get, they're each their own person with their own interests and beliefs and ways of cooking and styles.
Did you write the book as a we, or was it John and Vinny each had their own sort
of
voice?
Wrote it. Yeah, it was almost like a conversation.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
Yeah, it was fun because otherwise I didn't want to lump them into one personality. So they kind of, you know, we had a John and then a Vinny quote.
Yeah,
then, you know, it was fun, and we ate a lot of food, a lot of good food.
Yeah, the perks.
Yeah,
the wonderful perks. And then Sevier, meeting him during the blackout. And you being neighbors, often were you going over to his house to cook, him coming to yours?
Well, we knew each other for a couple of years before we even started working on a book, because his first book, Indian Home Cooking, came out right when I had met him, that he wrote that with Stephanie Linus.
Yeah, and you worked on American Masala.
Exactly, yes. American Masala. And then we have our third book, or my second book with him, but his third book's coming out in September, and it's called Masala Farm.
Yeah,
he has this farm upstate.
Chronicle, yes?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a beautiful book. It's about kind of his life up at the farm.
Yeah.
We knew each other for a while before we worked on a book together, and which was great because I kind of know I can take, you know, I can take what he says and kind of finesse it or play with it and mold it into what it needs to say for the recipe without losing him in it. And I think that only comes from really getting to know someone really well.
Yeah.
And talking with them a lot.
So do you see like a standardization of techniques by talking to, you know, Vinny and Ellie and Sevier, or is it just so across the board, like,
because cooking
they're
techniques,
yeah.
What do you think? I mean, I always ask, even when I'm starting this, when I'm starting to work with someone, I'll always ask even the most simple questions, like, you know, and this happened with John and Vinny. I kept asking, like, do you want to put pepper in that? They don't put pepper in anything.
Yeah.
And they're like, dude, how they would say, dude, pepper's a spice. It makes things spicy, and we don't like spicy food, and we use pepper really rarely. And so even those really small things that you might miss, if I just kind of blew it off and say, oh, I'm just going to put pepper, you know, salt and pepper to taste, salt and pepper. You really have to, you know, it's part of who they are and what they do.
I think when you first get to know a chef, there are, you know, there are certain ways, culinary ways to do things that are proper.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. Like, make a bechamel a certain way, or, you know, caramelize an onion, that's fine. But it is important to sort of understand how people cook, because some chefs like to use more oil, some like to use less, some like to grate their ginger on the microplane, some like to do it by hand. And those are all the little things that actually do sort of make a difference in the final product, and also do sort of help you get into the head of your chef. Yesterday I was on a photo shoot. I'm a food editor for Manhattan Magazine, and we're working on our restaurant issue. So we were photographing some chefs, and one of the chefs was talking about, you know, this is something I was thinking about, like in the context of writing a book. He said, yes, well, I never let, we would never use a bread machine. The spirit of the bread comes through the hands. Yeah. So like things like that, know, it's those kind of things that really help you develop an idea of someone's personality and perspective, you know,
what they're about.
I mean, I know people that won't use a microplane because they'd rather slice it with a knife.
I mean, you get a different flavor.
But the market also dictates, because as Raquel can also attest, you know, quick and easy is where things are really going a lot of the time. So there, if there are certain time saving things, sometimes the editor will request, or that's just sort of the way things go, but you try and find a good balance for that.
Speaking of technique, I wanted to get back to something we were talking before we went on air about mixing, about you know what I'm talking about, about, you know, certain techniques that get lost in translation per se. And that was a recipe that you were working on, right, Adina?
Raquel was talking about that.
And tell us a little about the...
Well, it's very funny. So I was working at Cook's Illustrated at the time, and, you know, Cook's recipes get tested out very analytically many, many times before they make it into the magazine. And at that time, a decade ago, there are people from the office that were testing recipes, and someone made one of the recipes and they said, you know, the recipe came out great. And I think it was cookies or something, you know, they came out, they were delicious and soft and wonderful, but you know, it really would have worked better if I didn't have to use my hand to mix it. And I actually was told to use a spoon to mix the dough. And it's like,
So it shows that there are no givens.
Yeah. I just recently had a really funny experience like that as well. I test and edit recipes for a magazine that is not a foodie magazine. Yeah. They include recipes, and the editors are lovely, and you know, they make me feel like an uber expert because they know less. You know, so the recipe was for a cut up chicken. Okay, so the three of us, just a chicken cut into eighths is something that you can purchase in the store. So we had this really funny back and forth for 2 days about the cut up chicken. And she kept saying, can you just tell me how many thighs and breasts it is? And I just kept saying, well, you know, in theory, it's eight pieces and da-da-da. Basically, what she didn't realize is that you can purchase a chicken cut into eight pieces. And she's like, I just don't want people to have to do that at home. It seems a little bit involved, don't you think? And I was like, oh, okay. So I said, you know, you can actually buy a cut-up chicken in any store. Yeah, yeah. She was like, oh, great. You know? So it just sort of... there's things get lost in transition.
I mean, other assumptions too. You were talking about toasting coconut that a lot of us take for granted, and some recipes will just say toasted coconut, or toasted nuts, or
fresh breadcrumbs, things like that, that some people are, and understandably, are foreign, and it's our job to make sure that people understand.
I mean, I don't know, it's just because of my awareness, but more and more often I see in cookbooks, you know, like, it's using olfactory a lot now too. Mm-hmm. Like a lot more senses are involved rather than this very, you know, standardized way of do this for 2 minutes, do this for 2 minutes.
Yeah. Well, everyone's stove is, you know, everyone has a different stove. Mm-hmm. Everyone considers, you know, what you consider medium high on someone else's stove. If they have like some crazy Viking or, you know, super slick.
Or a stove like mine that just fluctuates.
Or like the
crazy.
$200, exactly. Like the rental stove that we've all gone through. So I always try to give a visual and, you know, a smell, a visual, as well as a timing, because you never know what people are going to be, what they're going to be doing. And you don't want people to rely solely on time, too, because, your broiler for 4 minutes could torch something. I mean, could totally char it, and, you know, beyond recognition. So it's good to make sure people can keep a sense of that.
That happened to me, actually. I was working on a food styling set for the South Beach Food and Wine Festival cookbook. I was the food styling assistant for the book, and it was my first food styling job. It was in Lee Schrager's apartment in the Ansonia, and it was Spike Mendelsohn's toasted marshmallow milkshake from Top Chef. And the recipe said, you know, lay the marshmallows out on a foil-lined sheet and put them under a low broiler for 2 minutes. So I put them in, I was checking them, and all of a sudden, Lee's tiny apartment in the Ansonia filled with smoke. This is the first time I've ever met this man. And I said to my boss, Lori, I was like, Lori, there's a problem, there's a problem. And she's like, the kosher salt, you know. Yeah. So, and we were, the funny thing is, like, he was about as far away as you are from me, and we were trying to hide it from him in some weird way. Like, we thought maybe we could just sort of staunch the problem. But the point is that the recipe said broil for 2 minutes on a low broiler, but the broiling element was closer to the pan than I anticipated. So you really have to tell people, you know, check frequently until it turns brown, whatever, you know, stuff
and
like that.
And it's also why it's important to have a cross tester. Like, you know, I can test the recipes myself. I can write the recipes and edit them and work with the chef to make them what they are. But you still really want to have a third pair of eyes and hands in those recipes to cross test.
Third, even maybe fourth.
Totally,
Because when you do recipes, I know I've been involved in this where I get recipes to test from people who are writing recipes or testing recipes. Do you send it out to friends and family as well? It
depends. on a lot of things.
Yeah.
On depends what the budget
the
is.
The budget,
timing.
The time frame.
There's professional recipe testers who can blow through 10 recipes in a day.
Yeah.
Which we've both done before.
Or, you know, or you can send to friends and friends of friends and whoever's willing. But, you know, you really want someone to look at it. What I always say is with a professional recipe tester, you kind of get that. So if something goes wrong, how do you troubleshoot it? How do you fix it? Not just, oh, this went so wrong. And, you know.
Right.
I mean, what kind of notes, scripts, information do you look back, on, you know, like it went wrong and I would have done this and...
Suggestions, how to fix it.
And a lot of times I think we both take liberties because of where we are and what we do. Like, I'll send it back to, and I'll say, this didn't work. I just changed it to this way to work properly, you know, like, so,
but also sometimes, like, what might not work to me could be completely successful to the chef. So I always try to, you know, bring it back to them and say, so the tester said, or so was it really supposed to be this thick or this? Mm-hmm. I was working on some chili recipes for an upcoming fine cooking story and came across this, whereas I wasn't sure if it was right. And so just because I'm not from the, you know, region, the state where the chef is from, and they do things differently, mm-hmm. and, you know, so many different interpretations of a dish, it's really important to go back and make sure, because they could be like, yeah, that's totally how I want it. Whereas I'd be like, well, that's, you know, doesn't work for me, but it works for him, and that's what he wants, and that's what other people want. So, you know, you kind of also have to...
You have to remove your ego.
Yeah, yeah.
Always.
Do you have to remove theirs?
No, you have to protect theirs at all costs. Yeah. I would say.
Because, I mean, how often have you found yourself actually changing a recipe and then the chef imploring that rather than their old one?
It's a give and take. I mean, I think their word is as long as, you know, I think they're usually very...
Well, chefs are pretty happy to find out when something doesn't work. It's embarrassing to them. They don't want it out.
They don't want... The last thing they want is for someone to come up to them at an event and say, I made this from your book and it didn't work. So I think when it's technique-based, they're always receptive to the changes. And when it's a matter of style or taste, you really do have to divert to them, because you have to realize in the end, this is their book and you're the messenger. And you're working with them, and but for them, ultimately, you know. So that's
it's a balance. It's a tightrope.
And future projects you're working on. I know, Raquel, you're working with the lovely Matthew Weingarten.
Yeah, I'm working with Matt Weingarten on a great foraging and preserving and curing book that's going to come out in 2013.
The future.
Story publishing. It's going to be really different. Yeah. From what's out there, and really fun.
It's really cool. We actually got to collaborate a few years back on an edible Brooklyn Manhattan story with Matthews foraging for ginkgo berries.
Yeah,
I remember that story.
Yeah, it was excellent. I almost got beat up by a band of Chinese women who were foraging for those berries.
For the same ones.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, he was out there with his daughter, and it just was his sense of what's, you know, out there in the natural world. Mm-hmm. And by natural, I don't mean just farms and, like, what's actually in the urban environment. That
he finds chamomile in sidewalk cracks and, you know, wild growing blackberries and mulberry trees. And I mean, you know, working on this book with him, we'll talk about, I don't know, quince, and say, like, oh yeah, there's that quince tree on Atlantic Avenue. And it's like, what? Really?
Yeah.
There is?
Yeah. It's funny, I feel like there should be this underground trade of information as such, because, I mean, I know where a whole bunch of overlying fig trees are in Bensonhurst that go across property lines, and you're allowed to pick them.
Maybe you don't want to tell.
Yeah, no, exactly. I get a handful a year, I make my jam, and that's about it. But, no, it's fascinating that there is food all around us. It's just a matter of having someone there that has that vision to interpret it. And so that's a cool one. And, Dino, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a couple of proposals with chefs for books. I just finished developing 70 recipes for another health-related cookbook,
yeah,
all in about a month.
Yeah.
So it was an intense period of cooking. And then working on several food styling jobs and magazine pieces.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, do you find finding these humanistic single subject chefs, mm-hmm, to work with, mm-hmm, exciting, exhausting, otherwise?
No, not exhausting.
No, I think it's always, sometimes it can be a challenge in the beginning to figure it out. What's the book going to be? What's their voice? What's their food? But once you do, it just kind of rolls right off. You know, just it's so easy to, yeah, get,
I think,
on the
once
page.
They've bought in, then you, yeah, feel
there's a flow,
you feel emboldened and freed up to then bring your own voice back into it, because the reason it worked well is because you knew how to convey what they were saying, but then you allow your creativity to come back into it, mm-hmm, and you move forward with it.
Yeah.
So I just recently did like a sample chapter for a book, and you know, you hit the send button and you're just waiting for this person who you really don't know that well to come back and tell you whether you have properly, you know, expressed their viewpoint. And it's a quite an anxious moment when,
yeah,
you're sort of waiting. And in this case, it seemed to have worked out well, and I was so relieved.
Yeah.
But it could have easily gone the other way.
Well, I mean, you know? Have there been those situations where there wasn't the rapport and you said, I have to back away from this because this isn't going to be the best project for the both of us?
I don't think I've ever backed away from something after signing on, but
yeah,
there's definitely been instances. I mean, I've written, you know, I think 13 books now. I mean, there have been,
yeah,
instances where, you know, the editor might want something, the chef wants something else, and you're kind of caught in the middle and trying to make everyone happy. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, just passion and knowing what you want to say and everyone being on board with that. And that makes for the best book, I,
yeah,
think. Yeah.
So there is really no path to follow. It's just wait for a blackout or, you know, an odd introduction by someone's twin. And
yeah. I think just, you know, if you're interested in doing this, keep cooking. Offer to do jobs for free if you can find.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many food events, mm-hmm, and television shows and things going on, and there are potentially people that you could connect with just if you really show your passion. Offer to maybe test a recipe or assist them or do, mm-hmm, something and just see, you know, a lot of things do come out of just sort of chance encounters,
yeah,
you know. But I think, you know, also focusing on your writing, you know, if you're interested in doing this, it's really important as well.
Yeah.
Because it's not enough to just be able to cook. The writing piece is what really brings it all together.
Right. I mean, a good way to test the waters is if there's a chef that you really admire out there and you think you'd like to have a partnership with them or collaborate on a book or even an article, is to approach them and say, hey, you know, I'd really love to work on something, mm-hmm, with you, and start small. Maybe pitch an article to, I don't know, I don't really pitch that much anymore, do you?
Yeah.
A blog or a magazine,
mm-hmm,
or just pitch something. You know, even if it doesn't get picked up by someone, at least you develop that relationship,
yeah,
and you kind of get to know each other, and,
mm-hmm,
and it makes it easier to work on the cookbook proposal and then the cookbook, hopefully, if it sells.
Yeah, and I still think that chefs are really receptive and open to people who they see love food and cooking. And
yeah,
if you offer, it's the same way that you would offer to go work in a kitchen for free, which I did for a year while I was still working at the magazine. You know, twice a week I went at 5 and worked till midnight.
Yeah.
You know, if you show your, you know, your commitment to it, I think people respond and are willing to maybe give you a chance, you know.
And chefs, likewise, if you're looking for writers, recipe testers, mm-hmm, check out AdinaSussman.com, RaquelPazel.com.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been not only informative, but, you know, inspiring to see that there isn't a protocol, that,
yeah,
you make it happen because you want it to happen.
Definitely.
So, Raquel Pazel, Adina Sussman, thank you. You've been listening.
Thank you, Michael.
To the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Shout out to Sam Edwards and Surrey Farms for sponsoring. Jack Inslee for just doing everything, as always. Hope to have you here next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The new Whole Foods Market in Fairfield, Connecticut, is going to be generating their own clean power on site with a PureCell, that's a registered trademark, System Model 400 from UTC Power. I'm going to quote now from Tristan Coffin, the Green Mission Specialist for Whole Foods Market, Northeast Region. In connection to our company's green mission, we are very proud to be reducing our carbon footprint while producing clean energy in our new Fairfield, Connecticut location. UTC Power has been a great local partner in implementing our fuel cell to help us reduce our environmental impact in the Fairfield community. By generating most of its power on site with the fuel cell, the Whole Foods Market in Fairfield will prevent the release of more than 847 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually, the equivalent of planting more than 85 acres of trees. The reductions in nitrogen oxide emissions compared to a conventional power plant are equal to the environmental benefit of removing more than 100 cars from the road. In addition to the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, the PureCell system will allow Whole Foods Market to save nearly 3.5 million gallons of water annually. Unlike central generation and other fuel cell technologies, the PureCell system is designed to operate in water balance so there is no consumption or discharge of water during its operation. That's an awesome story. Kudos to Whole Foods. Don't you love that? This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Did you know we have a beer show? Check out a small clip from Beer Sessions Radio.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, and I'm here with Ray Dieter from the DBA Boys.
Hey, Jim.
Ray, this is a fun show. We're drinking Belgian beer. We're drinking Ichtigum, hanging out with the guys from the 124 Rabbit Club. And we got Don and Wendy from Van Berg and the Wolf. Well, let's go back a little bit to kind of build your pedigree. So the two of your top brands that we love and that you have now, Scaldis and Saison DuPont.
Yeah,
tell us how you met those guys, how you started working with them.
Well, Saison DuPont was really... that was.
If you want to hear more, head over to heritageradionetwork.com where new episodes of Beer Sessions are posted every week in our archive. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. The following is a message from heritagefoodsusa.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.